Sunday night edition of Movie Geeks United. Tonight, editor Thelma Schoonmaker, three-time Oscar winner, multiple-time nominee, including this year for her work in Hugo. I am Jamie.
And I'm Jerry. Welcome to our first live show. It seems like it's been a while.
It has been. We've been doing this Oscar series, so just Oscar nominee interviews lately. And we still have some coming up, but if you want to hear the Oscar nominee interviews that we've done, we've got them all collected at moviegeeksunited.net/Oscar. We still have a few more left. Tonight's episode, Best Foreign Language Film, Footnote, the director Footnote, and a couple of others, the composer of The Artists, and we've got some good ones coming up. So, speaking of Oscars, one of the award shows that is a precursor to the Oscars, like every award show really is, is the BAFTAs. Those were handed out within the past couple of hours.
Yeah, no, they were. And it seems like The Artist was the big award there, the big winner.
And do you take comfort, or is it discomforting to know that the BAFTAs are just as boring and predictable as the American counterpart?
I think a mixture of both. There really is. It seems like as each year goes on and on, there's no surprise really. Now I don't know the specifics of the BAFTAs. I like The Artist. I don't know if I adore The Artist, but I do like it. I just don't know. I have a confession to make. A Separation's been playing for a month around here. I haven't seen it. I doubt I'll see it in the theater. And it will win the Best Foreign Language Film, I'm sure. I just have very little interest in seeing it.
There's some movies like that for me, too, that I want to have already gone through the experience of having watched it without actually having to watch it.
Yeah. I mean, I would like to see it, but I've heard all this, you know, I was more interested in seeing the Madonna movie this weekend, but it opened only in one theater, so I just figured, all right, I'll wait till DVD to watch it. But I don't know. I mean, Jamie, is it just me, or does this season seem like already predetermined? I mean,
oh, it really, really does. And the BAFTAs followed the standard kind of thought behind what the Oscar winners will be too, which is
right.
Hugo, Jean Dujardin, Meryl Streep, Christopher Plummer, Octavia Spencer. That's the script that's been written for this award season from the very beginning, essentially.
Right.
I think the only question mark really among those categories is, will it be Meryl Streep or Viola Davis? I mean, that seems like the only contest, really.
Yeah, you're right.
Director is interesting because, well, the love of Scorsese, especially as it pertains to this particular movie, translate into a win over Hasna Vicious for director. That'll be another interesting one.
Well, I'd like some. I hope there is some surprise. I mean,
you got to grasp at it wherever you can find it.
Yeah, I mean, but it just seems like this is really following script. I mean,
yeah.
You're right. I mean, I just don't. I wish there was something. I don't know. We'll see. Maybe something will happen though. It's 2 weeks from tonight, right?
Yes, it is. What was the last shocker for you at the Oscars?
the last shocker may have been, and maybe this is just the first one that comes to mind, is I really did. I mean, I love Alan Arkin, but then he won over Eddie Murphy because it did seem like Eddie Murphy was the favorite that going into that for Dreamgirls.
Uh-huh.
But I was happy to see Alan Arkin win. Now, let me ask you this. I would think a surprise would be if Jonah Hill gets that, or if any.
Oh, yeah.
Or even Max von Sydow, if he got it, that would be a... I mean, anyone over... Chris, I mean, but I think Christopher Plummer has it, but who knows?
Yeah, and, you know, I think Christopher Plummer is deserving. And
oh,
honest,
of course. No one's denying that. I mean, no, of course not.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it's all kind of who's the best at a creative endeavor kind of... I mean, that's... It's splitting hairs. I mean, it's... I don't necessarily know that it's quantifiably judgeable, but... I mean, there have been some upsets in the past that have been shocking. I mean,
right.
I think you could hear the audible shock in the audience when they announced Crash over Brokeback Mountain.
Oh, yeah.
You could hear it with the Private Ryan Shakespeare in Love thing, too.
Right.
Just people completely shocked that Roberto Benigni won Best Actor. That's like one of those really out of left field wins.
Well, maybe something like that could happen. Let me ask you this. I do, and I said this a couple of weeks ago, I think on our last live show, I think there's a possibility in the Best Picture category The Help could walk away.
Mm-hmm.
I am looking at that. I just was really intrigued by that thing over the Tavis Smiley debate between him and Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer. And
right.
I just thought, Viola Davis, I was like, wow. I mean, wow. Is all I
well, because that was an argument. I mean, Tavis Smiley argued that he applauds the talents of both actors. He applauds Denzel Washington. But whenever a person of color is nominated, or not necessarily nominated, but wins an award,
mm-hmm.
it's always for playing the killer cop without morals or the maid character. There's no in between.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. And then Octavia Spencer brought up a good, but look, you know, you look at someone like Anthony Hopkins, Hannibal Lecter, or Marlon Brando and Robert De Niro for Vito Corleone. And if you look actually at the people who are winning the awards, we're talking about killers, psychopaths, not.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. We have in a sense we're awarding. We almost like these like shady characters almost, but I understood what Tavis Smiley was getting at. But I was happy to actually see Viola Davis just really dig into him.
Well, yeah, and in a respectful way.
Respectful way.
But you know that she questioned this herself, and you know that it's been questioned of her before. I mean, it's
right.
an argument that she knows exactly how she what side she falls on. Mm-hmm. She knows how to articulate it.
Right, and she did a wonderful job, I thought. I was really blown away by that.
Yeah. But it's, you know, I guess it's a conversation worth having. Like The Blind Side was a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Like, by not bringing race into the equation of The Blind Side,
right.
was that... did that make the movie less than it should have been, or does that make us less than we should be to even bring something like that up? I mean,
right. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's an interesting topic of discussion. But it's in a way that I never viewed.
Right.
I wouldn't even think about because I don't come from that experience.
Right.
I didn't even realize that was an argument.
Right.
But ultimately, The Help. Succeeds because of exactly what Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer articulated, in that it connects because of the humanity
mm-hmm.
of the characters, and it doesn't matter if they're maids or, you know, or billionaires.
Right.
And honestly, if you see a movie with a billionaire in it, you're probably not going to connect with the humanity of the characters.
No,
character.
That's true. I mean, that's a very good point. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. So, I'd be fine if The Help won. I think it falls in line with The Artist in that it's a true audience movie.
Yeah.
I think The Help gives an audience a fuller experience because it taps into other kind of points other than just kind of delight and sheer kind of entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
it challenges a little bit more. But
yeah, it does.
But the artist is, it feels like a safe bet. I mean,
I think it is. It looks like right now with everything, especially with the BAFTAs tonight, yeah, that's where it's going. Unless there's something I don't know, that looks like where it's going.
But in terms of emotional poignancy, will anyone remember The Artist 10, 15, 20 more years from now? I don't think so. And shouldn't that be the criteria, one of the predominant criteria of a Best Picture winner? It's not only what it represents in your industry at that point,
mm-hmm.
which I don't know what a silent movie necessarily does represent, but at this point, but how durable that movie will be, how it will endure, how we want it to represent us years from now.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, even if, all right, let's say Hugo gets it, how, you know, that's another one. It's interesting. Of the three...
See, I think Hugo's better
oh,
suited.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Because Hugo itself is about legacy.
Yes. I agree with you 100% there. I think Hugo is the better film. I do like The Artist, but I think Hugo is the better film. I think then if we're going on that basis, what if Midnight in Paris? What if everyone really goes for that?
Well, I'm not just picking on The Artist. I mean, The Artist is a delightful movie. I would actually personally apply the same logic to another Scorsese movie that won, which is The Departed. I mean, The Departed is a perfectly great movie.
Mm-hmm.
It is his B movie, and I don't know that its resonance will necessarily carry over
it's 20 years
from now.
It's a remake of an equally good B movie, mm-hmm. and. You know, yeah, you're right. Where does that stand? But let me ask you this: Where do you think No Country for Old Men will? Do you think that will stand the test of time?
I think No Country for Old Men has this mystery to it. It feels like one of those slightly ambiguous movies,
mm-hmm.
that from the '70s that people go back to and kind of rediscover today. And it's very haunting in a way.
Yes, it is. I agree with you.
The ending of that movie, I think, really... I mean, some people were ticked off. It ends like that, and so suddenly with that monologue, and what's the point of that?
That monologue is beautiful.
I think that monologue is the movie. It's the movie.
Yeah.
That's the title, No Country for Old Men.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's that closing monologue. And
yeah.
I think it kind of leaves you in that state, at that closing monologue, where it becomes a deeper experience than what you thought that you'd been seeing for the past 2 hours.
No, I agree with you on there. Well, we'll see. Maybe, I don't know. I mean, it just seems like this... I mean, let me ask you this. Is Clooney not a sure thing?
I guess
not.
It doesn't
seem like he is. I mean...
He's been campaigning pretty hard, too.
I mean, he's...
He's been doing Q&As all over town for various guilds and things,
mm-hmm.
with the cast. I mean, he just did one a couple of nights ago, which was the last time the cast was assembled, and it was
officially
assembled, so all the cast members could sing praises of George Clooney.
Right.
As an actor, you know. I think he's great. Look, Jean Desjardins, he's phenomenal in The Artist, and he accomplishes something very specific, and he's got charm to burn.
Yeah, and he showed that last night on SNL. I mean,
yeah. But, I mean, look at the particular demands of a role. I know that Desjardins' role was particularly demanding just because of the format and
mm-hmm.
what he was asked to do to give a very physical performance.
Right.
And then, you know, which are a different demand called upon for Brad Pitt or George Clooney.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's different kind of skill sets. That's why, you know, it's kind of silly, a best of
mm-hmm.
anything. And really the best of anything depends upon the writing and the opportunity the writing gives an actor.
Right.
Yeah, so it's all kind of interconnected. Anyway... Good talk. I'm glad we had this talk.
No.
You want to hug it out?
I want to hug it out, definitely. Hug it out. And then you're left with someone like Gary Oldman, who it would be. I mean, I think it's an awesome performance, but mm-hmm. it would be for I would like to say for a whole body of work, stretching back 30 years.
Yeah, and inevitably, some awards that they give out do act as body of work,
mm-hmm.
kind of. I mean, that's, you know, the prime example being something like a Paul Newman in Color of Money.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, Gary Oldman nominated for the first time, and hopefully he's on Oscar's radar now, so they'll repeat that.
Yeah.
That nomination process a couple more times for him, but I don't think this is the role.
No, I don't think so either, unfortunately. I don't know if it's going to be for Commissioner Gordon in The Dark Knight Rises either. Although I do think The Dark Knight Rises will be nominated for Best Picture. Although that may be premature on my part, because you've got The Hobbit will probably be in there and Django Unchained. Possibly.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, if it's anywhere near as effective as the last one. I mean, that's
the big question. That will be. We'll be talking about that more during the summer, I'm sure. Obviously, but
I mean, The Dark Knight is one of the whole reasons why we think they expanded the category to.
I think so. I think you're absolutely right. Definitely.
Yeah. Well, on the heels of this Oscar talk, let's go ahead and play our interview with Thelma Schoonmaker, a legendary editor, probably the most celebrated editor in the history of film. And a longtime collaborator of Mr. Martin Scorsese, movies like, you know, starting out with something like Woodstock for Scorsese,
mm-hmm.
and Raging Bull and The Color of Money, like we said, and After Hours, Last Temptation of Christ, Cape Fear, Goodfellas. I mean,
it goes on and on.
Whenever anyone talks about classic schooling and editing, and great editing,
mm-hmm.
they always talk about that sequence in Goodfellas, where he goes about his day and he's coked up, ever-growing paranoia. He's
yeah.
trying to cook dinner, trying to trade off guns, trying to sell drugs, and all the time the helicopter flying over. Is it really flying over? Is it just his mind playing tricks on him? I mean, oh, it's a beautiful example of inventive and daring editing.
Mm-hmm.
And she's built a career off of that in all these great Scorsese movies. It's one of the great collaborations in the history of film, I believe. And she's nominated this year for her work in Hugo, Best Editor.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked to her about Hugo specifically, and a lot of the other collaborations popped up too, including Kundun, of all movies.
Oh,
talked
wow.
about Kundun.
Okay. Cool.
There you go. I try to bring up Kundun in any interview I do, really. Okay, so here is Thelma. Enjoy it.
Right after my father died, I would come up here a lot. I'd imagine the whole world was one big machine. Machines never come with any extra parts, you know. They always come with the exact amount they need. So I figured if the entire world was one big machine, I couldn't be an extra part. I had to be here for some reason. And that means you have to be here for some reason too.
This is particularly thrilling because to get 11 is so fantastic. I mean, I was listening to the radio and they were saying, before the announcement, they were saying, well, you know, Departed and the artist, they're going to get all the nominations, and there's a couple of films that might get a few, like Hugo, and they had us number 6 in line. And then I got up and made my breakfast and I heard Martin Scorsese's Hugo wins 11 nominations, and I shrieked out loud because it's so lovely to that many is amazing, and it's the most we've ever gotten. And also the great thing about it is that we have such a lovely crew that works all the time with Marty. And we're very dear friends. It's like a big family. So that means that every member of the family almost was recognized, and that was really lovely, except for the actors, but and makeup, I think. But to have all of the people that I work so closely with, you know, be recognized, it's really lovely.
Well, I would think that the recognition for this film is particularly special because it is about the love of film and passing that on to a new generation. I mean, it's very meaningful.
Absolutely, and we were quite stunned at how wonderfully children reacted to it. It's not just a children's film. I mean, one of the things we're trying to make clear now is that it's very much for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I think some people didn't go see it because they thought it was just a children's film, but it's not. It's much, much more than that, and everybody enjoys it. So, but we were rather afraid at first that when we first showed it to children, that they would be throwing popcorn and texting each other. And it was pretty scary, and they were just riveted to the screen. It was wonderful to see. I mean, Scorsese and I sit in the back of the audience because we talk to each other all during screenings because we're still editing and making changes, and we say, oh, let's drop that, let's tighten that. Just looking forward at the kids, nobody was moving. I mean, it was unbelievable. And then afterwards, in the cards that they write and tell us what they think, they just kept saying how much they love the silent movie clips and the movie making. And they gave us incredibly high numbers, much higher than the adults, actually, which were very high also. But these were, like, you know, 95% excellent. And that was such a joy to think that the film was impacting them and reaching them. I think it's very important to try and, you know, not to dumb down, obviously, and actually try and stretch the audience. And this was what was happening with these kids. It was wonderful to see. But it's also a distillation of all that Scorsese has done over the years to rescue the reputations of the masters who went before him, and how he brought Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger's films back to the world and brought Michael back to the world, and had done so for so many directors and so many films, like the Egyptian film Al-Momia, which he restored. It's really a distillation of that, I think, this movie. So because we love film history so much, you're right that it was a particularly joyous film to work on.
Absolutely. And you're right. I mean, the film definitely encompasses all of that. And I was talking to Robert Richardson last month about Hugo. We talked about much of the same thing in that when I was watching it, I was thinking about Mr. Scorsese when he grew up and the movies that he watched that led him to want to become a filmmaker. And I was thinking maybe someone of the new generation coming up will be watching Hugo and they will be inspired in that same way.
Oh, gosh, I hope so. I hope you're right. That would be wonderful.
So it's such a beautiful kind of thing. But also, I mean, so many of Scorsese's films are about movie love. I mean, this one explicitly. So do you kind of find yourself immersing yourself in whatever kind of genre or world or particular filmmaker he's kind of paying homage to in some of these projects?
Yes, I mean, there's always been something different for each film, by the way, but there's always been something that is sort of an inspiration for the movie we're making. And for example, in Gangs of New York, you may have read this, Marty wanted the opening fight sequence in the snow to be cut like Eisenstein's Potemkin in a certain way. There's a sailor who breaks a dish. He's washing a dish on board the ship after the crew has been fed food that's crawling with maggots. And they're furious about it and ready to revolt. And he sees on the dish, give us this day our daily bread. And he smashes the dish. And Marty said, look at the way that's cut. He didn't use the downward arm movement. Eisenstein instead, he used the up arm movement. He fractured everything so that the way the shots are used is almost like a plate fracturing. Mm. And it was a brilliant little moment, and he said, that's how I would like us to cut the battle sequence. And so we did. We tried to use things sometimes you wouldn't put in a film, like the blood on the snow underneath their feet.
Right.
Instead of actually somebody hitting somebody. There's a lot of people being hit, but and fractured it all and changed the speed of it. And that was all deeply influenced by Eisenstein, for example, just that one battle scene. And so there's always something in each film. He shows the crew movies before we start shooting, and that so that they're imbued also with that inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
And of course there were many films to look at for this one, so, and many
little secret
homages that are sprinkled throughout, actually, to films, which is really lovely.
Is it a difficult process, because I know that you've also edited movies about the documentaries with Mr. Scorsese about the history of, I believe, American movies and the British cinema. I think you're
doing the British now. We haven't finished it, but the Italian cinema was a particularly joyous one to work on. Those films, of course, of the neorealist films of Rossellini and the men who followed him, Fellini and Antonioni. They were, De Sica, they were enormous influences on Marty when he was a young child. You just cannot overemphasize how enormous those influences were. And it was a great joy to work on them and find a way to edit the clips so that the audience was hopefully feeling for the film the way they would if they saw the whole thing. And what a powerful period of filmmaking. Lord, I mean, it just burst out of Italy like a thunderbolt. I don't know. I mean, it must have been the conflict of fascism and communism under which they were living as Mussolini was in power, and the desire to protest against it and not be able to must have been the crucible in which this great work was formed, and then the war, of course, just solidified that, and these masterpiece after masterpiece came out of that period, so it was
absolutely
such a joy to work on, I can't tell you.
Well, but when you edit, when you kind of pull highlights and different scenes and things from other people's work, such as Méliès for Hugo, is that a daunting process?
Yeah, well, it was very hard. It's always hard, because our original edits on those montages of clips were like four times longer, you know, because there are so many incredible things that Méliès did, and that amazing sequence where he's throwing his head up into the music staff, that I would have loved to have put the whole film in, because it's so brilliant. And even our visual effects person couldn't figure out how the hell he did it until he really studied it. But yes, it was very hard to cut down and remove things that we loved, and it is when we do the documentaries too. Of course, we would like to make them 15 hours long.
Well, particularly
my
with
my husband's films are very hard to clip. Because
that's what I was going to ask. Yeah.
Yeah, because films that he made with Emmerich Pressburger, his great partner, were so complicated and subtle, and they're not easy to convey to someone who hasn't sat through the whole film, because they are so masterful. I mean, Scorsese's films in a way are that way too. If you have a filmmaker who's a little more cut and dried, it's much easier to pull a clip than it is from a film that is deeply felt and thought out and resonating throughout with very real truths about human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, they don't have cliches in them. Cliches are very easy to clip. But since there are no villains in Marty's movies or certainly not in the films Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger made, there's never a villain. It's always in the gray area of human behavior, never the black and white, You know, mm-hmm. Michael never saw life like that. He didn't. He always saw the complexities of human beings, and so there's never a villain, and there really is never a villain in Marty's movies either.
Right, I agree. And you know, you guys have worked together for so long, and I've been curious with an ongoing collaboration like that. Has there ever been a time when you've had difficulty connecting emotionally to a piece of material?
Oh, no, never. I mean, one of the great things about working for Marty is that each film is different, and it has, mm-hmm. it's a different challenge, and we all get to go over the hurdle with him. And so, no, never, ever. I mean, there's always such powerful emotion in his movies that I've never had that problem. No, I mean, the problem is that sometimes I'm weeping when I'm looking at the dailies.
Yeah.
For example, the not only, of course, the crucifixion in Last Temptation, but the in Hugo, of course, the end scene where mm-hmm. He thanks the boy in the gala, I was weeping during dailies and while I was cutting it. And then the end of Shutter Island, interestingly, when Leo's character decides to have a lobotomy, was terribly moving, the way Marty did it on the steps of that building, where at first you can't quite figure out what's going on, and neither can the Mark Ruffalo character, who's the doctor, who's the psychiatrist,
mm-hmm.
because Leo is telling him what he thinks Mark wants him to, what, you know, he knows that Mark is expecting some sort of behavior from him. And so at first he's sort of feeding him that behavior, and then he very mysteriously shifts into something else. And it was so beautifully directed and acted.
Yeah.
It took a while to get to the right moment, but, oh, it's just heartbreaking. So I never have a problem with Marty. Never.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, you've expressed a couple of instances of kind of deep emotional connection to the material, and yet your job as an editor would also require you to have kind of I don't want to use the word cold, but a more kind of distant, observant eye. Is that a difficult balance sometimes?
Yeah. I mean, it you're quite right. That is what Scorsese relies on me for, and that I can look at it with a little more perspective and distance than he, who has been dreaming it up, coming up with a conception for the entire movie, a conception for the camera work, a conception for the editing, for the music, for the acting, and he's been then co-writing the script and then directing it, and he sometimes feels he just gets so close and buried in it that he needs a colder eye to look at it from outside. So I read the script once, and then I don't read it again unless there's some restructuring or something that we have to do and I may have to look at it. But I try and let the film evolve before my eyes in dailies when I'm looking at them alone before I look at them with Marty every night. I just prefer to see how the film is evolving, not from what I remember from the script, but what is actually there, what he's captured.
Right.
And then work with that. And it's true that there are some times when I can see something he can't see because he's so close to it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I have to say, well, we're going to have to drop that, unfortunately. Because in all filmmaking, one of your jobs is to cut the film down. And it's always very painful. And sometimes we have to lose Marty's favorite scene or my favorite scene. That happened in After Hours. And in order to make the film work. So it is part of our job, though, to have that unfortunate scalpel waiting to cut something. Yeah, it's very hard.
But it is amazing, and it's something that obviously audiences aren't privy to because they're not in the cutting room. They don't know what they're missing. But when you find that you cut frames or a minute or seconds from a movie, and it changes the tone or the pace of the whole thing. It's very mysterious. Is there an element of mystery that remains for you?
It's amazing to us sometimes what happens when we cut something down or rearrange it and then screen it, because that's what we do. We screen about 12 times. Most people don't. but we still are able to insist on that because that's how we make our movies. We screen it. I debrief people afterwards. And when we start with a smaller group and then bigger and bigger until we get to 200 or 300, at which point we have to give them cards. I couldn't possibly debrief them all. But it's amazing what you learn from audiences. Things that you thought were working aren't at all, or they don't understand something, or they think something isn't funny that you hope they would think was funny. So you have to keep going back and reworking and reworking. And as you do that, it's very mysterious how things evolve. And even we sometimes will try something and then screen it and go, my gosh, that made that character emerge, which we didn't expect, you know. It's quite interesting, but you would have to sit here for 6 months and I make 1,000 decisions a day. It would be so boring. But I wish there was some way that I could sort of show people. One day I will. I'll show all 12 cuts, you know, and show what happened in between so they can maybe get some. I never get time to put that together, but I do have to at some point. It's important.
I think so, too. But you guys do such bold, risky, there's a sense of experimentation going on a lot in some of these films. And it, with the editors that I've spoken to in the past, I mean, they refer to editing as the invisible art. But, I mean, I'm very aware of the cutting in Scorsese's movies, but they further my investment in the film emotionally.
Ooh, that's a very beautiful way of putting it. Yes, he is a great editor. Editing has always been his passion, and it's his favorite part of filmmaking. And his early films show, his student films even show, incredible, bold editing. And that has always been his predilection. That's why Eisenstein is so important to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he and I really would sometimes like to slap the audience in the face instead of being invisible, you know. And it's funny because sometimes I've been criticized by my peers. At one point somebody said to me, why did you do that jump cut in Goodfellas? And my answer to him was, which one? I mean, there were so many. We were dealing with particularly one character who runs the nightclub. And he was a person that Marty had seen on at 2 a.m. in the morning on some very strange local show. And he said, oh, that guy is brilliant. I want to have him in the film. But he was not a trained actor. So when he was improvising with Paul Sorvino, he wasn't sometimes aware of what a professional actor would know to do at times. And so sometimes I had to make some awkward cuts. But the improvisation was so brilliant. Who cares, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But some people object to that. And if you go back through the history of film, you will find mismatches and bad jump cuts all over the place. So it's the least thing for people to be concerned about, as far as I'm concerned. We usually, you know, they used to do this thing where they would write up how many jump cuts we had done or how many bad cuts they think that we had done in films like Goodfellas, and there were 300 or something. I don't know.
Please.
It's ridiculous. You have to do what's right for the movie, even if
That's it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I would think that the style of cutting a Kundun is much different from cutting a Goodfellas. I mean, the requirements
Age
are...
Age of Innocence is the same, yes. I mean, we had to slow down when we did Age of Innocence. Of course, Kundun was a great joy to work on because we fell in love with the Tibetan people who were there, you know, 400 of them, and became very much part of the cause, of course, and of trying to get them freedom from China. But they were so lovely, and they weren't actors, and they were wonderful because it was their story they were telling. And they felt so deeply about it that they were unbelievably good. I mean, we were just stunned at how good they were. And that was a joy to work on, you know, because it was coming just out of their being. It was in their souls. And it was just heaven to work on and to remain friends with them for the rest of my life. And it was, Marty did ask me to study something there. He asked me to look at the book of how sand mandalas are made. Beautiful idea of the monk spending 2 weeks creating these beautiful sand mandalas with colored sand and funnels. That's it. And they make these beautiful things, and then after 2 weeks, it's washed away into the river. A very beautiful Buddhist idea. And so Marty said, I want to shoot a section of the sand mandala to open the movie, and I need to know what is important. You know, what does that god mean, and what does this mean? And so I got to go watch the monks do one, and it was just heaven, and then learn about it, read the book, and that kind of thing goes on a lot in our movies.
I wanted to ask you about one film in particular, because it's the Scorsese film that I go to most often. I watch it at least twice a year, and that's Casino.
Oh.
I've always adored Casino. And I think about the accomplishment of that movie, and there were so many balls that you had to kind of balance up in the air, because you had multiple narrations, multiple character arcs and storylines, and a very a kind of an epic canvas, but told in a very intimate way. Tell me about that experience of putting that together.
Yeah, that was a very hard movie to cut because of, as you say, because of the narration, and we reworked the narration in the beginning, because I just felt it wasn't explaining clearly enough what was going on, how the mafia was controlling the casinos. And Marty was a bit reluctant at first, because he, you know, my husband Michael Powell said to us, never explain, which is a very good thing to try and do if you can in movies, but sometimes you have to. And so we just kept rewriting and re-recording, you know, the actors doing that. It was very, very hard to get it exactly right. And it could be a little bit sprawling, that movie, because of the nature of it. And the wonderful thing that's happened, and you're actually making that clear, is that when it came out, it was very badly received. You know, it's not Goodfellas, people said. No, it's not Goodfellas. It's about Las Vegas. It's something entirely different. So it has to be different. We can't keep making Goodfellas over and over again, as much as everyone wants us to. They always say to us, couldn't you make the last 20 minutes of the film like the last 20 minutes of Goodfellas? And we say, well, you know, the Dalai Lama is not on coke. And it's a little different, the situation here. He's fleeing for his life into India, and it's a tragic moment for him, and we can't cut it the way we cut that insane last 20 minutes, which was a joy to cut, by the way. And again, we were using very dramatic jump cuts in there for a purpose, to convey the fact that Henry Hill is bombed out of his mind, and that, so the film should make you feel like that a bit, that everything is disconnected. And so anyway, Casino was a different situation, but now everybody is, you know, talking more and more about that film, particularly young people, which is great. I mean, it's such a victory. Our films often take 10 years to be recognized, and they're often, you know, excoriated when they come out, and then 10 years later, like Raging Bull, that happened with that, and Casino. So I'm glad you feel that way. It's got incredible stuff in it, doesn't it? I mean,
it does. And it's one of those movies, I mean, it feels like you've gone through such a full experience. But a lot of movies that you see nowadays kind of bombard your senses, and they exhaust you when you walk out of it. But this one always makes me feel kind of elevated and more alert. I mean, it just fires off my brain in a very special way.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, we're so happy to see this happening. The only one of our films that it hasn't happened to is Bringing Out the Dead, which is very interesting. I don't know why, but because it's about compassion, and it was actually advertised as a car chase movie, which is a little bit off the mark, and it didn't do well at all. It's too bad, because the it came out of Kundun in a way, you know, because that's the one word that the Dalai Lama uses all the time is compassion, compassion, compassion.
Yeah.
And that's what's going on with Nicolas Cage as an ambulance driver in that movie. Anyway, maybe one day it will.
I think it's bound to happen. I look at Bringing Out the Dead, and I look at the other kind of New York-centric films you guys have done together, and they're such vivid, different portraits of life in that city.
Yeah, the difference between After Hours and Bringing Out the Dead, for example. Yeah, of course, Marty, there's no one who can lay the city down the way Marty can.
Right.
As hard as it is to shoot here, it's in our blood, and you know, the danger of living in the city is all part of it too. It's such a rich environment, and it's nurtured us.
Do you find that if ever you look back at some of these films, and I know you've probably had some occasions to do so, but is your mind consumed with the choices behind the cuts, so you're not able to kind of enjoy the film as an audience would?
No, I mean, you mean if I looked at something like Casino Now, is that what you mean?
Mm-hmm.
No, I would be aware maybe of a couple of times when I would be uneasy about something I couldn't make work as well as I would like. It impacts me. It's good, actually, not to see them for a long time because you do suddenly see them the way the audience does. We try so hard to remember what we felt when we first saw a daily of something.
Yeah.
You know, I write it down even, and we want to try and never lose that. But you tend to, as you're editing, you tend to lose it. So it is great 10 years later to look at something and feel it like the audience does. I still notice things, you know, where I say, ooh, I wish I could have. But
right.
not too much. But I know, I do feel it. But it takes some time.
Who are you?
Hugo.
Where do you live?
Is it a secret?
Yeah.
Oh, good, I love secrets.
So you're all alone?
Not completely.
Where did you get this?
Why would my key fit into your father's machine?
Do you want to have an adventure?
Let that child apprehend!
It's roaring.
I think it's a message from my father.
This is a treacherous place. Do you understand? Watch your step.
It's Neverland and Oz and Treasure Island all wrapped into one. Are you sure about this? We could get into trouble. That's how you know it's an adventure.
My life has taught me happy endings only happen in the movies.
The story's not over yet.
Okay, that was Thelma Schoonmaker, legendary editor of editing companion of Martin Scorsese throughout his career. Just an incredible body of work. Nominated for Best Editing again this year for Hugo. And that is the latest interview in our Oscar series. You can access the other interviews with Best Makeup nominees from The Iron Lady and Albert Nobbs. Another Best Editing nominee, Kevin Tent, for The Descendants. Best Sound Editing, the lone nomination for Drive, Mr. Lon Bender. Let me tell you, that's an interesting interview. You don't necessarily look at... It's always fascinating to talk to someone like a sound designer, sound editor, because you, as an audience, you're not really privy to how much the sound tells the story.
Right.
I mean, everyone on the crew is an assistant storyteller, and that's so true of the sound designers and editors, too, because he was going through a sequence from Drive and the thought process behind the different sounds he put in and how that illustrated character in a very special way.
Right.
And especially a movie like Drive that depends upon, so much upon mood and atmosphere and this kind of sensory experience that you have with that movie to kind of transfix you.
Right.
Sound is very important, as it is in any kind of, it's the same way we talk about Lynch films and how sound plays a key role in those. Also, Best Picture nominee Brunson Green, who is one of the producers of The Help. And two Best Short Film nominees, Max Zolli from Raju, and Andrew Bowler and Gigi Cossi from Time Freak. And this couple, they're married, director, writer, producer of Time Freak, and they're the couple that videotaped their reaction to hearing that they were nominated.
That's
and,
right, yeah.
Oh, it was a beautiful, beautiful thing. If you're a movie fan and that doesn't get you choked up, I don't know what will. But also on our page, our Oscar page, moviegeeksunited.net/Oscar, you'll find video reports reporting throughout this Oscar season from L.A., from Hollywood, from our Oscar correspondent, Kristen Burt. And I'm going to play this brief clip of a report that she filed for the nominee luncheon, which happened on Monday.
That's right. Yeah, cool.
Last week. All I have to do is just refresh this page, and then you'll be hearing that sound clip. I like this nominee luncheon because, and a couple of the guests that we've had on this series have talked about their experience in the luncheon too, because it's so democratic. I mean, they see everyone is just, it's just a whole kind of feeling of family and community.
Right.
All of those who are honored kind of get an equal feeling of belonging there.
That's true.
You know, even the photograph that they take of the whole group is they're arranged alphabetically. So you get these really kind of different groups of people standing together. And one of the nominees, the, I believe it was Andrew Bowler, talked about he was standing next to Chris Columbus.
Oh.
So Andrew Bowler's nominated for Best Live Action Short Film, and he's standing in the photo next to Chris Columbus. And he said that they Chris Columbus had never been nominated before. So he was new to the whole Oscar thing, too. And he was looking around as wide-eyed as Andrew Bowler was. And they were both talking about how they couldn't believe either one was there, you know. It's a great feeling of community from that. And they seat people in kind of random order. So, you know, Gigi was at a table with Steven Spielberg. She said she passed the butter to Steven Spielberg. And then there's a reporter there, and there are a couple other nominees. But, I mean, it's not like a favorites at a certain table or buddies
right.
at a certain table, you know. So that's a great thing. Here is Kristen's nominee report that she filed for us, and we'll be right back on the other side of this two-and-a-half-minute clip.
This is Behind the Red Carpet with Kristen Burt from Movie Geeks United. Hey, everyone, it's Behind the Red Carpet with Kristen Burt. Now, I just left the 84th Annual Academy Awards Nominees Luncheon at the Beverly Hilton. The exciting thing about being in a press room is that you get up close and personal with all of the nominees in the acting categories. So here's a fun few takeaways that I noted at today's luncheon. Now, it's a great opportunity for all the nominees to get together. They get to meet each other. They do take a class photo, believe it or not, and they get a certificate which honors their nomination. But in talking with some of the actors, I really found that a lot of them are very excited to be hanging out with Brad Pitt and George Clooney. They seem to be the cool kids in the club. All of the style magazines, of course, want to know what the ladies are wearing in terms of their dresses. Surprising to find out, not a lot of ladies know yet. One or two have confirmed their dresses, but in general, most people think it's a little too early to worry about what they're wearing on February 26th. Now, some really interesting things, because I think what was great to see about this year's nominees, we have people in their 20s that are nominated all the way up to their 80s. So it's a really wide range of actors that are being honored at this year's award. Jonah Hill and Brad Pitt came in together, and Jonah Hill was a little bit reserved. Brad Pitt was talking a lot about the making of the film and how important it was to get the Billy Bean story out there, talking a lot about adversity, which I think we hear over and over. And again, we heard that with Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer, how hard they've worked to get to this level and that they're finally getting the recognition after all of these years. Viola Davis kept on saying, at 46, I am finally here. Melissa McCarthy, she's so amazing. I'm not sure if she was able to take it all in. She was very emotional, almost teary-eyed. But she is another one that's good friends with Octavia Spencer, so it's really been an incredible ride for all of them. And Michelle Williams is the only back-to-back nominee this year, so it was nice to see Michelle Williams back. She's a little bit less shy, a little bit less reserved now that she is a veteran on this whole Oscar nomination circuit. This is her third nomination in total. But I'll tell you, the person that got the most cheers, and this is just like Javier Bardem last year when he was nominated. This year, it was Demian Bashir. A lot of the outlets are excited that he is nominated. In fact, he is the first Mexican actor to be nominated since Anthony Quinn. So there's a lot of excitement surrounding his award. So it was really a fun opportunity to get up close and personal with all the nominees, because the next time we're going to see them all together is going to be Sunday, February 26th, live from the red carpet at the Kodak Theater. This is Behind the Red Carpet with Kristen Burt. We'll see you next time.
Thank you, Kristen. Well, that's something. Demian Bashir, the first Mexican actor since Anthony Quinn.
Yeah, I know. I mean,
wow.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that's something else.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you can hear our Demian Bashir interview, too, from a couple of weeks ago. But what a sweet guy. And that's one of the big triumphant stories of this year's nominations, too. I mean,
right.
that they'd single out a work like that, and which is so incredibly deserving. And also a movie that otherwise probably wouldn't get the play
mm-hmm.
without Oscar's exposure on it. So, I mean, that's where the Oscars are valuable, too. So, speaking of non-Oscar topics, what did you see from this week?
Well, I mean, when was the last time we were on?
Well, it's just, I guess, the Vow. I take it you did not see that.
No, I did see the. I've seen The Vow and I've seen Safe House.
And Safe House was okay.
Safe House was excellent. You know, speaking of Denzel Washington playing badasses, it was pretty good. But it was also Brendan Gleeson was in it. He's good. And Ryan Reynolds is very good when given the right part. Is good. So yeah, it was cool. But you know, with the Safe House, the problem with Safe House is they show you the trailer for the Bourne Legacy, and you're like,
uh-huh.
Can it be August right now? Can it be August? Can we get to that right now? Thank you.
You're excited about that movie?
Oh, I think it looks. I mean, they got everyone. I mean, obviously, it's not going to be Paul Greengrass and Matt Damon, but they have Jeremy Renner, and you know, it's got everyone else from the Bourne movies is in it.
Right.
So let's give it a shot, all right? Let's give it. Come on, it's Tony Gilroy is directing it. I mean,
did the
really,
other movies come out in August? They were all August releases, weren't they? Or
what? Well, I think Identity was a June release, and then
okay.
The rest were August. But I mean, I think the story of the weekend is that people really wanted to see The Phantom Menace in 3D. No, but can I say something? I've said this before, and I'll say it again. I've said this many times today. Everyone says, oh, we want to go back. It's our childhood. And revisit. And I'm guilty of this, too, in 1999. Oh, we want to feel like children again. Can I say one thing and one thing only? Why don't we start saying, why don't we start acting like men? Is that too much to ask? Why don't we start acting like men, paying bills, doing the right thing? Let me say this right now. Childhood is overrated. Childhood is a great lie. Childhood is a great whorehouse of lies. Let's start acting like men, because that's what the only important thing is from this point forward, is acting like men and not acting like a bunch of losers trying to reclaim this childhood that really wasn't that golden to begin with. All right? Let me say that right now. I don't want to hear this thing, oh, that George Lucas raped my childhood. If your childhood was that steeped in crap, and I'll be the first to admit this, you know what? My biggest problem with The Phantom Menace wasn't that it sucked. It was that I was much more interested in other things by the time The Phantom Menace came out. And, yeah, I had to regurgitate, and I had to regress and say, oh, yeah, it's a really good film. Then I went to go see it again, and I was like, my God, this really sucks balls. And then Attack of the Clones comes out, and it's like, oh, my God, really? Really? But, no, let's start acting like men. This childhood fascination's over, all right? We're in our 30s and 40s. Let's just go forward at this point. Thank you.
So you don't buy the argument that people go to the movies as a form of escape?
I buy it as a form of escape, but it's what if you listen to the show I did with my mom a couple of weeks ago, movies are like basically the equivalent of Oxycontin, painkillers. They don't last long. I like The Artist. I think The Artist is a very, very good movie, but I also think there's something dishonest about The Artist. And, you know, we talk about, oh, how happy everyone was walking out. But guess what? By the time you get to the car, you're reminded, oh, shit, I got problems to deal with. You know, you're...
Yeah, but who said that movies could solve your problems?
No, I didn't say they could solve your problems, but I said, my God, they could last longer than Oxycontin for 4 or 5 hours. I mean, come on. I mean, yeah,
well, some
I realize I've become the bastard of the show, and I have no problem with that. Someone
yeah, but your liking of movies has lasted your entire life. That's
I don't
something
know about
that has lasted.
I think my liking of movies has maybe come down to a chemical thing at this point. I like the artist, but I don't love the artist. I like Hugo a lot more than I like the artist. I like Midnight in Paris, but my God, I need something that's going to last longer than the availability of over-the-counter painkiller at this point. Sorry, I'm just a negative son of a bitch, and I'm happy about that.
Well, I think the movies mean something different to us now than they meant during our formative years. And I think movies that people carry with them tend to be from a certain time in their lives, more so than as a 40-year-old man or something.
Well, 40-year-old man or 41-year-old man. But you said it best. You know, where will the artist be in like 10 or 15 years? And we were talking about this earlier with my mom. I don't think the artist is going to have the same impact that The Godfather has. I don't think the artist is going to have the same impact that Fight Club or Kill Bill has, for that matter. They, as you keep revisiting them, let me throw in another one there, Treasure of Sierra Madre and The African Queen. You will revisit those films, I think, every 10 years and be like, wow, they mean something different to me. But maybe none of them more so than The Godfather. I think The Godfather may, even more so than On the Waterfront, may be the greatest American film, the greatest film ever made. I don't think I've seen a film that I've wrestled with. I'm talking about all three movies, not just the first one. I go back and forth. There are years I have no problem with him killing Fredo. I think it's justified. I think it's beyond justified. And then there are times I'm like, well, maybe he should have just, you know, sent him to the farm. You know, just said, hey, buddy, you know, you screwed with me. There are days I don't have that problem.
In the realm of that particular drama, it's justified because it's dramatic and it adds to the tragedy of that character. In real life, I mean.
In real life, if your brother screws you over, if your brother says, there was something in it for me, I gotta be like, you know, hey, you took sides against the family. Guess what?
And you have to kill. I mean, it really doesn't mean the justification doesn't mean anything in a courtroom. You know, well, you know, he betrayed the family. That's why
he did betray the family. Let's be very blunt here, Fredo. Screwed the pooch big time.
But the drama and why the movie is so classic is because everyone understands Fredo. He's not a villain. He's a weakling that always wanted to be taken seriously, that so wanted that kind of acceptance, and that led him. And you see that in all crosses of life, that people that are so desperate to be loved make bad decisions in their desperation to achieve that. And that's the story of Fredo.
That's what makes Fredo so great. But I was like talking to my mom earlier. I was like, you know what? All right, if he didn't do it in two, he would have probably sided with the Vatican and Immobiliare in three. Probably he would have probably. Hey, there's something in it for me. $600 million. I want a chunk of that.
But this is my point.
I'd like to talk to that, too, for that matter. God.
I've actually got a couple of points in relation to what you just said. Because the first part of your rant consisted of essentially an argument that movies don't matter because they don't have that much of a lasting impact. And now you're talking about The Godfather, a 40-year-old movie that's had an impact on your life, on your sense of things.
Yeah, but that's just one movie. But there are other movies, though, unfortunately. I guess you could say current movies. It's just like, you know, it's good, it makes me feel good, but you know what? Now, The Godfather is that, except, and there are a couple, obviously, there's several movies, but The Artist, it goes back to what you were saying, The Artist isn't going to, in a year from now, The Artist is what, I could care less.
Very few movies are. I mean, very few movies can be anything like The Godfather. I mean, it's a different, Coppola couldn't make The Godfather today, I don't think. Because I don't think he has that he's got a different poetry in him now, you know?
He's got way different poetry in him now. I mean...
But you can't ask the godfather of movies anymore. You can't expect it, you know?
You can't expect it. But why is it then someone like Scorsese or even someone like Eastwood, for that matter, is going into the well? And, like, you know, I'm not saying, obviously, J. Edgar is not the movie I'm looking, but someone like Eastwood is still, like, 80 years old. Oh, my God, that curiosity. But there's someone like Scorsese who's still delivering the goods. But Coppola, it's not there. Maybe Coppola feels he doesn't have to do it anymore.
I mean, they're just different people.
Yeah.
You know, and Coppola's been through his journey, and this is how he's kind of defined the last part of his life, just by getting back to his independent roots.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's perfectly fine with not reaching the heights of his 70s output.
I don't see it. I don't see that he would have... I mean, I just from the last two movies, at least, I haven't seen the one with Val Kilmer, obviously, but the last two movies, he's just not... It's not there anymore. It's just not there.
I think he's trying to find a spark of what initially interested him in making movies. But the thing about his early movies, The Godfather's and Conversation and... Mm-hmm. Apocalypse Now, is just how reflective they were and introspective beyond his years. So I would have hoped that in his advanced years, as he is now, that he would bring that kind of wise kind of, you know, this is what I've learned mm-hmm. about living and life that he had in those early movies that seemed like they should have been directed by men 30, 40 years older.
Right.
You know. Because of just how wise and knowing they were about regret and the journey of life and the tragic consequences of actions and that kind of thing. I don't see that in his
work. He does that with Tetro. I think he does do that with Tetro. There's something going on in Tetro that's not there with Youth Without You.
Mm-hmm.
But there's definitely something going on in Tetro.
Yeah, and it returns to the family, which is the major... important
theme
throughout
his life.
That is,
the major, that is
yeah.
the major ethos of Coppola's work, the family.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gangsterism is really a second thing. I mean, it's really about family with him. And I think that's why, I mean, we talk more about The Godfather than we do about other gangster films before and after that. I mean, to call The Godfather a gangster film is insulting.
Well, it's the tent post. I mean, it's the movie upon which every other subgenre imitation,
mm-hmm.
you know, is judged. And it's an impossible standard.
Yeah, no, it is an impossible standard. But, I mean, no, but when I was going on, you know, the artist, you know, I like the, like I said, I like the artist, but even like our friend Roland, who texts me a lot, he's like, would I like the artist if I don't really care about silent films? I go, dude, you know, I like, yeah, that's up to you. I'm not going to tell you how to spend your money.
this is a point I brought up a couple of years ago. It was a point I brought up when The Departed was nominated for Best Picture. And I said, does the meaning of a movie need to come in, does the meaning or importance of a message of a movie need to come into play when you're voting Best Picture? And everyone said no. But my point was, the lessons that we learn from a movie like The Godfather, or even a Star Wars, because I think that people responded to these original Star Wars.
Oh yeah,
films
we all did. I mean,
on an allegorical, kind of moral, mythological level. I mean, it wasn't that. Oh God, look at that spaceship! What really makes it last is the content, what it's saying, and how it's saying it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what makes any movie last. So when you're looking at a Departed or Shakespeare in Love or on and on and on, or any nominees for Best Picture, should that come into play? What is it saying about us? What is the value of its message of what it's trying to say? Should that come into play?
If it's going to stand the test of time, yeah. Because this goes back to the whole argument of the kid that asked Siskel and Ebert, why isn't the film like Lethal Weapon 2 nominated?
Right.
And I love Lethal Weapon 2. I think it's a great action movie. But if that's going to, you know, you and I both know, Chris knows, even Dean, I know Dean, that's not going to be nominated for Best Picture.
Yes.
But let me ask you something like this. What about something like Driving Miss Daisy? Do you remember that? Is that something that you're really like, let me ask you this. Is that something on your deathbed that you're going to be like, that's the best fucking movie I had ever seen? No! You're going to see Born on the 4th of July.
From that year, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that just connected and resonated with me.
Yeah.
On an emotional level.
I think that connected
level.
With a lot of people. I mean, Driving Miss Daisy, yeah, it's great. Jessica Tandy gets the Oscar. That's wonderful. That's great. Dan Aykroyd isn't making a jackass out of himself. That's wonderful. But maybe he is. I don't know. But
It's a sweet, non-threatening movie, and so is The Artist.
Yeah. The Artist actually maybe even... See, this is the thing that's interesting about The Artist, is that it has, obviously, I think it's hit a nerve with people with a certain segment that remembers that time, maybe, or remembers that time from their parents telling them about that time. Oh, this is how movies used to be. And I think there's something of that there. But then you have these stories of people who are like, I want my money back because no one says a damn thing during the movie. I didn't know it was violent.
Yeah.
And you have to wonder. That's like those Tree of Life people. This is not like the Mexican. What are you talking about?
All right. We got a phone call on the line. Let me take this phone call real quick. We have a 323 area code. I believe it's Hollywood. 323. Yes, you're on the air.
Hey. Hey, Movie Geeks, what's up?
Hey, what's up, baby? How you doing?
Hey, good. I'm in Phoenix, actually. I'm an independent filmmaker. My name's Rocky. I'm a big fan of you guys.
Thank you, man.
Thank you.
You're a big fan
of this show. That means a lot. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, I listen to it every week. It's great. I heard you guys talking about the Oscars and everything. You might know, Jamie or Jerry, did either of you see, I posted on your Facebook wall the Temporary Setbacks Episode 1 web series?
Yes. Yes, hey.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, okay. Okay, I got you. All right.
I know who I'm talking to now.
Okay, good. Yeah, that's, if anybody's listening, facebook.com/temporary setbacks.
Okay.
For the, we're doing a whole web series here in Arizona. And we're big fans of you guys. I mean, it's nice to listen to other film enthusiasts, you know, and it would be great to get the word out on your show too, to get to, you know, every week we're going to try to release a new episode.
Well, thank you, man. Well, that's the one of those episodes is on our Facebook page too. So, did you have thoughts about the Oscars?
Yeah, I do. I agree with you guys. I don't think The Artist should win Best Picture, but out of the other nine, I mean, or out of the other eight, what are the two of you like really championing for?
Hugo for me.
Hugo.
Nothing. You want the God's honest truth? Absolutely nothing. I really got to say, I mean, first of all, I'm just, you know, I don't get anything out of it. I really, you know, I know people have said, oh, the Oscars is like the Super Bowl for me. I'd rather go, like, snort cocaine off Stephenie Meyer's ass or something, to be very honest with you. I'm not making that up. I really wouldn't. I don't do drugs or anything. But I'd rather just go hang out with the bitch that wrote Twilight and snort cocaine off her ass than watch the Oscars this year, if you want to know the God's honest truth.
Did you see the headline about Twilight lately? Catherine Hardwick was talking about the initial screenplays for Twilight, and she said, initially, those screenplays really sucked. And I was like, initially?
All right, with the four that have been done, and I mean, they do get progressively better, like that irritable bowel syndrome would be the worst case, and then just mild diarrhea would be the last one. But,
right.
I mean, what, really?
She was talking about the original, the initial drafts of the original. Anyway, I'm off topic.
I know. All right, so I know I'm not championing any. I mean, I think, you know, if the Descendants won, I think that would be good, but I don't. I honestly don't know. I couldn't tell you. I really don't. It's not. I get nothing out of it as I get older.
I'm championing.
Yeah.
I'm championing Hugo.
Let's go with Hugo. Yeah.
just because.
Okay, I need to. That's one of the three I need to see out of the nine. I haven't seen Hugo, War Horse, or The Help out of the nine.
Well, if you're a filmmaker, I would think Hugo would be the one that you should see. I mean, because it celebrates the very passions of probably why most people want to make movies, as well as go to the movies. Yeah. And that's why I think it's a worthy movie to champion a book.
I mean, I like War Horse, but War Horse, we're talking about old-fashioned films, and War Horse is a very old-fashioned film. I think it's very good, and I think it's a very good Spielberg film. I'm surprised it's up there because the impression I was getting from the Academy screenings is, oh, we don't like it.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just like, oh, we don't like this. And they obviously didn't like Tintin, obviously. I mean, I saw Tintin. I was just indifferent towards it. I was like, okay, this is great. I mean, my older brothers read the comic books that's based on, and there's a whole, and that's done very well all over the world except for here because no one's heard of Tintin.
I'm surprised that they don't like War Horse though, because people characterize the Academy as this old-fashioned, you know, behind the times kind of group, and War Horse has a very sentimental kind of throwback feel to it.
Oh, it does. I mean, it's right up there with the other films we've been talking about. But I don't, you know, did you see this thing that, oh, people were, like, laughing during the trailer for War Horse? People couldn't take it seriously. Like, oh, my God, Spielberg's releasing this? I'm like, it's actually a very well-made film.
Spielberg doesn't make movies that aren't well-made.
Yeah, I just can't get over people, like, ragging on this film. But they are. People are ragging on it.
Well, and they're bringing in the Holocaust now with the artist. There's a Holocaust connection to it. And, I mean, this which seems like a last-minute Hail Mary.
Wait, where's the Holocaust mentioned in the artist now? I did not go to the bathroom during this film. So, wait, where is the...
No, it's not implicit in the film. But they're saying there's a Holocaust connection, not exclusively to the film, but a Holocaust connection to the people that created it. I have to read on it because I just read the headline on it. But it really does seem like a last-ditch kind of...
Oh, my God.
And consider this. I mean, if only someone in the movie, like, were playing a disability or something. Because that's an Oscar bait kind of thing, too. I mean, they could throw that in there. But they're doing everything they can to pull the...
Tim Novak's reaction to the score, the Vertigo score.
Great. Yeah. I didn't know. I mean, she felt like she was being raped. I mean, she'd never watched a Quentin Tarantino or Brian De Palma film before.
She felt like the artist was a Holocaust on Hitchcock's memory. Maybe that's the Holocaust connection. Here's something about Brian De Palma, though. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, man.
She must not watch a lot of movies. Like, every once in a while, she'll pop in a DVD that they send her, and then finally, it just...
Well, that's how she saw it.
The
Academy screener that she just popped in. You mentioned De Palma, and I just wanted to mention this. The weirdest movie headline I've read in a long time. Brian De Palma is remaking a Burt Reynolds movie starring Jason Statham.
Wow.
So it's the Heat movie with Burt Reynolds, right?
Yes.
It's got to be better than the original. I mean, I'm sorry. I mean, it just has to be better than the original.
What a wacky project. I mean, I saw De Palma set to remake Burt Reynolds' film. I was like, what, Deliverance? Maybe I can see Deliverance. What's going on here? Heat. Jason Statham will play a recovering gambling addict who works protection gigs to pay the bills. He refuses to use guns in dealing with foes, and resorts to using his fists.
He's got the right tool for the job in this one.
He's practically a fist model.
I mean,
when his friend is beaten by a high roller, he helps her get revenge, which puts him in even more danger. It's just a strange choice of De Palma
that
as a director.
That is very strange. What happened to Toyer? Is that still going on, or...?
The thing that he's shooting now is Passion, which is the erotic thriller with Rachel McAdams and not Rooney Mara, but the original actress of Dragon Tattoo.
Oh, well, I think we'll
Nomi Rapace.
a special tribute show for that. I know. I will be, at least.
Boobs and De Palma on the next Movie Geeks United. That'll be that show. And who can resist that?
I can't resist that. Oh my God! I mean, we're really gonna. Well, that'll be good. I mean, he'll definitely come on for that.
Did you see Tree of Life, Rocky? Did you say your name was Rocky?
Yes, it is Rock Schroeder. Yes, I did.
Good
see
movie.
Tree of Life. It was. It's one of those movies where I don't know if I could recommend it to many people, but I personally loved it. You know.
I was talking about Rocky being a good movie. Were you named after Rocky?
I was born in 1977 at the end of March and right after the Oscars.
Look at that. See, Jerry, that's how movies matter and last a lifetime.
Well, I love Rocky. I think the first two Rockies are, and even the third one I like, but no, Rocky is awesome. So if you're named after that, that's incredible. I mean,
it won Best Picture. I always joke about, like, if I was born the year after, I'd be named Annie Hall.
It's better than being named after the lead in Taxi Driver. I mean, that would kind of curse you, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, got a lot of security checks with that one.
I have a younger brother who's named Rocky too. Rocky number two. I'm kidding.
That's funny. Anyway, Tree of Life.
Tree of Life. Amazing.
The DP of that film says, who will probably win the Oscar, says there's a whole other movie that you can make just from the Sean Penn subplot.
Wow.
Yeah.
No wonder Sean Penn said he didn't know what he was doing in that movie in the final cut.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure he's disenchanted just because he knew what the movie was that he was going to shoot. It turned out to be something else, but that's Malick. I mean,
yeah.
You can't argue with that. Now, do you think Tree of Life has a chance, though? I mean, there is that possibility. I would have no problem with that. I mean.
Oh, I would love that. I mean, Tree of Life was my favorite movie of the year.
But I would have no problem with Tree of Life, one of those two. I mean, obviously cinematography. If it doesn't win cinematography, that's a huge crop. I mean, forget it. I'm turning the show off.
Yeah.
I'm turning the show off and going to a strip club after that.
Are you gonna do what Al Pacino does in Heat, where he just throws the TV out the window or out of the car?
No, because I can't afford to get a new TV, okay? I can't do that. And God knows I have anger management issues, but I can't do that, okay?
See, his family, and he did that because his family kind of connived behind his back, meaning his wife in that movie. So that mirrored the Fredo thing. He shot Fredo, but he just got rid of his TV in Heat.
If he only did that in Godfather 2.
I think that's progress.
It is progress.
If doesn't he walk in and his wife has a man in the apartment or the house?
That's a great scene. I love that scene.
A side note, but it's also, you know, self-promotion for myself. In episode 2 of Temporary Setbacks, my web series, I actually have a cameo at the end where I'm the guy where the lead actor comes in, walks in on his girlfriend in bed with me. So he grabs his guitar and leaves, but I should have had a scene like an homage to Pacino, you know.
That's right. Every movie would benefit from an homage to Pacino.
I don't know about Jack and Jill, though.
here's something that, you know, obviously the big news yesterday was Whitney Houston, and you know, it's a tragedy,
and all of us
understand that, and we're empathetic to it, but it brings up a couple of, and we were actually going to welcome a filmmaker that's worked with Whitney Houston tonight, and I just thought against it, but it brings up a couple of interesting points, and I forget how it's related to what we just talked about. Oh, okay. Sometimes I talk so much I forget what I was initially going to say. In terms of legacy, like, people will dismiss her legacy because of what kind of turmoil her life has gone through the past 15 years.
That's BS. I disagree with that totally. I mean,
yeah, but look at Pacino too. And this is what I thought: people dismiss Pacino's legacy because of the awful movies that he's been filling his resume with the past decade.
Okay, can I say something here? He could make 20 more Jack and Jills But he played Michael Corleone. I mean, forget Tony Montana, forget the characters in Heat, forget Dog Day Afternoon. And those are all awesome, awesome roles. But he played Michael Corleone. If he did nothing else, if he made 40 Jack and Jills, it wouldn't take away from playing one of the most important characters in American cinema and fiction. Come on. I'm sorry. But
no, that's my point.
Yeah.
That's my point. Because the fact that she's had these struggles does not negate the fact that she was already a legend in the music
mm-hmm.
industry. She
yeah.
was already the first woman ever to have a number one album. And all these kinds of records that she set. But somehow it's distasteful that she's defined by these past 15 years. Just as Al Pacino, you know, Al Pacino, I'm always, like, so fascinated to watch him. He entertains me in whatever he does. Just
right,
like,
right.
Huge Pacino fan. But the fact that he's in Jack and Jill, how does it sully his legacy when his legacy was built on Corleone and Dog Day and Scarface? Those
and
are there.
Serpico, too. Serpico,
yeah.
Let's not forget. And Scarecrow, for that matter, yeah.
Those exist. They're there.
Yeah, I mean,
they've already been accomplished.
And what's interesting about that is, you know, it's not like Whitney Houston, you know, like I'm not a huge fan of her music, but I recognize that she was immensely talented, and I would never badmouth her. So she had problems, so she succumbed to things. You know, let me say this, who doesn't?
Yeah,
and that's another
just,
thing. Yeah. But it didn't. But her thing, it's not like she. It's interesting with the Pacino analogy. You know, yeah, Pacino made some bad movies, but as an actor, and I think everyone on this show who listens to this show, as an actor, you also take what's given to you, or you take.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think people understand that exactly. Sometimes,
well, I guess singers too. I guess
yeah,
singers
do. But she never released a bad. Thing. That's also the other thing. You know, we're talking about things that existed outside of her art.
Yeah.
All
right, yeah,
with
yeah.
the exception of the reality show, which I think, which unfortunately, I'm sad that she did that because she let us in too much into her private life, maybe.
It's a sad train wrecky thing.
Yeah,
you know,
but it doesn't detract from what she gave to all of us.
But there's also this. I mean, people said that her voice was disappeared, but, you know, and I equate it with acting, too. When you look at a Pacino or De Niro, and we've said this many times, they impressed so much in those early performances. There was this intense fire in the belly
mm-hmm.
to do something legendary, to add to mm-hmm. the history of the acting art form. And you saw that because the cinema of the 70s kind of accommodated that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when with singers, they can't do the kind of vocal acrobatics at a certain age that they did when they were younger.
Mm-hmm.
But what singers have is a kind of a life experience. And
right.
it's not about how pristine the notes are. It's about what they convey with their voice
mm-hmm.
and with their interpretation of a song. Look, Tom Waits has technically the worst voice you've ever heard. But there's nothing that is not in his voice.
Right.
I mean, there's all of life. Like,
recent album is incredible. I mean,
this guy has lived through everything,
mm-hmm.
and that is so much more valuable than, oh, my God, listen to that note she hit.
Mm-hmm.
That's what true singing is. So in terms of acting, and we talked about this with Coppola, I would hope in this last act of these people's lives, these creative artists' lives, that they find a different way to express their talent, like a different, you know, the fire's no longer there to kind of redefine, but what do you carry at this stage of your life that can be valuable in this particular performance?
Yeah.
But the movies very often just aren't there. And so you're an actor. You're a working actor. You want to work.
Yeah.
So what, are you going to wait for the next Godfather?
Yeah.
You're not going to work.
Yeah, you're going to want to do that. And that's a point. I don't think people really understand that. I mean, Michael Caine will be the first to tell you that he's a working actor.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I don't rule it out that De Niro. I mean, I like De Niro and what just happened, and I think Pacino definitely has a couple more really good roles in him. I
yeah.
really do. I do believe that. I just think they need to be written, or he might have to write them. I think we forget about that with both of these guys, that they are, at a time, they were two of the greatest actors of their generation. But I think there's still work to be left that they can still do. I don't think they're
mm-hmm.
out of it. But we all know, and like I said, everyone who listens to the show realize you're a working actor. you know, you know, not everything is going to be gold. And you just got to do sometimes the only thing that comes your way, if that's the paycheck, you know, we all have bills to pay.
And they set the bar. I mean, just like Whitney Houston set the bar. You know,
yeah.
Singers now, they look to Whitney Houston, and that's like the Tempest. If only I could sing like Whitney Houston.
Yeah.
And Jennifer Hudson's probably the one that comes closest.
Yeah.
People look to Pacino. I mean, the whole generation of actors only got into it because they saw Dog Day Afternoon. Or
yeah.
Pick another Pacino performance from the early years. So, I mean, it's indelible. I mean, their impact is indelible. And snotty people that try to belittle it by Jock and Jill, you know,
yeah,
like
I
that
mean,
dismisses anything, everything.
Yeah, I mean, you can't use, I mean, let's even, what's the other, I mean, obviously Righteous Kill wasn't over 88 minutes, but there have been other performances where he has, I think, tried to, he's definitely tried to recapture some of the magic, and he's trying to break new ground. And I think there are, I do think with someone like Pacino and De Niro, there are still performances in the future that hopefully we haven't seen.
And it's also ignorant because it completely ignores what they're doing in that movie.
Yeah.
I mean, actors have a variety of reasons why they choose certain material. Because, I mean, Jackie Jill is not a good movie. But look
but
at
do
what
you
Pacino,
expect that to be a good movie when you're going to see that? Do you really expect that, oh, this world movie is going to rock my world? I mean,
no. I mean, it would
I
be
don't.
Great if it did. But they completely ignore what Pacino is doing within that movie,
mm-hmm.
what reasons he might have had for doing that movie. And it shows an ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with a lot of the other movies. Like, I'll take Everybody's Fine, which is the De Niro movie.
Right.
Where he plays essentially an About Schmidt character. And I think the movie is not very good. But I think he is very good.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he outclasses the movie big time.
Right.
And
I
he's
agree.
Doing so,
I
he's
second
do,
that.
Yeah. He's doing something very kind of unique in his career in that movie. And that's
mm-hmm.
a big kind of step for him.
Right.
But people are dismissive of it because the movie's not any damn good. And they can't separate. They can't differentiate between, you know, one and the other.
I mean, I agree with you 100% on these on points. Now, let me ask you about the other actor of that generation, though, Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
How Do You Know? And The Bucket List. I don't think The Bucket List is very good at all, but I understand why he would do something like that. What about How Do You Know, though? A supporting performance.
I see why he did it, because it was a favorite of James L. Brooks.
Right, okay.
But
that's what I was thinking, too, yeah.
But those are movies that offer him no other kind of colors that are interesting to him to play.
Right.
About Schmidt did, even though some people, and I kind of thought the movie was ho-hum in the whole arc of Alexander Payne's career. I thought it was probably the most ho-hum of his movies, and I love all of his movies. But,
right.
But what he was given an opportunity to do and to explore in that was very worthy.
It's very worthy, and he could not. And I don't know if you had really adapted the book as written, that movie would have pissed off a lot of people. I don't think you could have adapted it the way it's written. I mean, he is a very hateful character as the
well,
book.
And you could see Nicholson doing that.
Right.
But what made that character so great was that we've always known Jack Nicholson. And Rocky, you're still on the line, by the way. I'm sorry we've hijacked your phone call. But what always made Nicholson so great was that he was anti-establishment.
Mm-hmm.
And so how interesting would it be for him to take on an About Schmidt, you know, this kind of ultra kind of conservative
mm-hmm.
establishment kind of guy.
And he is that. He's very much that, yes.
I think that's a great kind of color for him to explore.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he can't be the guy that chases tail his whole life in all the movies, you know?
No, he can't. He can't do that. I actually thought that's what made Something's Gotta Give so much fun, is because he could.
I think he's very effective in Something's
yeah,
Gotta Give.
I think
give.
That's another great role.
And I think that explores, like, at that age, what romance and love
mm-hmm.
means and what you bring to the table
mm-hmm.
and, you know, is there twice as much baggage or are you willing to let go of certain things because you reached that certain age or where vanity comes to play.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that was specifically interesting, especially for Nicholson, you know?
Oh, definitely. I hope that he has some more stuff that he wants to do, because he's a fascinating... Hell, for that matter, I hope Warren Beatty decides to do something.
I think Warren Beatty's capable. I think I don't know what to think of Warren Beatty, because he's been in some great vehicles. I mean, I think he's great in Shampoo.
Mm-hmm.
I think the movie's great. Bunny and Clyde's obviously a classic. But, I mean, people think of him as a lightweight actor, and they think that the only time he really shines, the only time where he really gives a performance is Bugsy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just the nature of the performance. But I think that Warren Beatty is such an artist that he has something that he wants to express about Howard Hughes in this last
mm-hmm.
in this last movie that he's making. And I think there's something probably about Howard Hughes that melds with Warren Beatty.
Oh yeah.
And I think it can reveal something special.
I agree with you. Anything by Beatty at this point would be a welcome gift.
And all this talk and all this passion that we're sharing about this whole entire conversation we've been having. That's why movies matter.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm just saying some of them. I mean, I'm just like, some of them just feel like painkillers to me, though.
Yeah.
And I hope you understand what I'm getting at.
Well, some are.
I hope I haven't wasted everyone's time here. I mean, just
no,
go
you
on,
haven't.
Watch The Walking Dead later. I mean.
But actually, I heard you talk about that with your mother on the show last week. And I wanted to talk to you about that.
Yeah.
Because I understand what you're saying, but there are all kinds of different movies. And plus, and some are just exist to let you forget your troubles for a couple of hours. And that's noble.
That is noble. It is noble.
But I also wanted to bring up the idea that of what I said earlier about the formative years. I mean, because when most people talk about their favorite movies or the movies that mean the most to them, it's the ones they watch as a teenager when they first fell in love with movies.
Mm-hmm.
Or as a kid when you're first like taken aback by the majesty of what movies
right.
can accomplish. It's different when you've reached our age where we're approaching middle age. We're so inundated with daily life and the,
mm-hmm.
and the struggles of it that a movie can't really solve anything, you know. And you're more set in your perspective of things too, I think.
Let me ask you this, and let me close with this, I mean, at least on that argument, because that's one of the things I was getting at, and this is something that people were getting at 12 years ago, is, you know, I do think, God, you know, that one guy is going to probably write to us. I do think The Phantom Menace is a poorly made movie.
Sure.
I mean, I think it commits the ultimate sin, is boring.
Well, above all, it's a poorly written movie.
Yeah. But let me ask you a bigger question, and this is something that many people brought up, and especially then when Attack of the Clones came out, and forgive me for going retreading in this territory. Could it be, as someone pointed out, we just grew up, and that was another thing? I say that, but then I say, well, look at something like the fascination with the Lord of the Rings, and that was the same kind of movie in essence, and that we all gravitated towards because it was well made, though.
It was well written.
Well written. And
you know, but you know, and I think about that too. If we as approaching 40-year-olds
mm-hmm.
were watching Star Wars the original for the first time, would we think, oh God, this is childish crap? And I think that's a perspective that we can't kind of we can't define. I mean, it's impossible to kind of say either way. But it's possible. I guess it's possible because
it
Lucas
possible.
Himself said kids watch the new episodes. And they're struck with the same sense of wonder that we had with
the
first ones.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. It's very interesting because, you know, when my mom took us to see those movies, she was like, this is just like, you know, the serials that we used to go see as kids, you know, that my father and they would go see, you know, every Saturday afternoon or something. She didn't think it was anything really. And she only got because God, I dragged her to see it so many times that she fell in love with it. But, you know, there was that, you know, it was a very interesting. There was a generational thing. But then I noticed the same thing with what the Wachowskis did with the first Matrix film. That not that much different from what Lucas did with Star Wars. They took everything that came before and put it into a neat package. It seemed fresh and original. And that's why, you know, there's a whole younger, like, generation Y or the millennials really fell in love with that movie.
Yeah, but, yeah. I would say the major difference between that and Star Wars is Star Wars had this cast of multiple characters that were memorable,
mm-hmm.
and that would go down in folklore. I mean, when I think of The Matrix outside of Neo, maybe, I don't really think character
mm-hmm.
popping off the screen, you know? But I will say, like, out of all the Star Wars movies, I think it's generally agreed that Empire
is the best one.
But Lucas didn't write that. You know,
he didn't have anything really. He was away from the set.
He plotted out the story. He knew exactly what he wanted to achieve. He gave it to another screenwriter to
mm-hmm.
bring to life, gave it to another director to realize. And I think that that's what makes them so strong. Lucas is great. He has a great vision.
Mm-hmm.
He has a great sense of a story arc.
Yeah.
He's not a great writer.
No, he's a horrible writer. That's what I've learned. He's really a horrible writer, but like you said, he's an awesome idea man.
Yeah.
Awesome, just awesome idea man.
Rocky?
Yes, Jamie.
See what you got us into, man.
Yeah, see what you did, Rocky. Now I want to pick up some boxing gloves and go box now.
Yeah, so your theme of today's episode is movies matter.
I guess that's what it turned out.
I guess so.
It turned out that
we basically, with Hugo as the centerpiece, yeah.
We started with Thomas Schoonmaker, and then we get into Movies Matter. So.
Well, yeah, that works with my name, me being named after a movie, and just having the passion and just this joy and everything. I just want to make movies. I make, right now, they're, no budget movies made with a lot of love and passion.
That's all that matters. But remember, Rocky has one of the greatest speeches in it when he talking to Mickey, and he says, I never had a prime. I haven't had my prime yet. And that's
right.
One of the truly great movie moments. I mean, we're talking about movies that matter. That's the scene. Forget the fights and everything. When he talks to Mickey, he's like, you insult my place and all this, but he says, you had a prime. I've never had a prime. I'm over the hill.
And the movie is all heart. I mean, the movie connects because it's heart. It's all heart.
That's one of the best scenes in the movie. I mean,
and to me, very few things in life outside of family,
mm-hmm.
very few things in life mean much of anything except for creativity and the need to express ourselves and the need to kind of feel like we're one with others and articulate feelings that let people know that you're not alone.
Right.
And no art form is more collaborative and kind of epitomizes that sense more than movies for me. And that's why movies matter. And that's why I'm running for president in 2000.
Are you running for president? Wait, which ticket are you running for? Were you at CPAC this weekend and I didn't know it?
No.
I mean,
no.
No, I didn't
anyway.
Think so. I didn't think so.
Okay, good talk.
Awesome talk.
A group hug, guys. Come on.
Group
Rocky,
hug.
Jerry.
We got Rocky on our show. I mean.
I know. Okay, Rocky, tell us one more time how we can find your short films.
Yeah, definitely. We have a Facebook fan page, so you can go to facebook.com/temporary setbacks because, that's the theme of the series. It's about this guy who he faces every episode as a temporary setback. He actually has to go back and live on his mom's couch.
Mm.
So it's something that everybody's, a lot of people are dealing with right now today in the economy.
Yeah.
So it's called Temporary Setbacks, and you can also go to me and my friend, Mark Perot, who's in L.A., he's editing and composing the music for it. And he's a huge Bernard Herrmann fan, by the way.
Mm.
And he loves your Kubrick and composer interviews you've been doing.
Bless him.
Yes. So proactivepictures.com, that's our banner company. So, yeah, you can go to proactivepictures.com. You can go to the Facebook page, like us. And then you can always get the updates whenever we post a new episode.
Awesome,
so it's good. And I'll post another link on your fan page just to get more fans to your site and vice versa.
Awesome. You do that. And I appreciate you calling in.
Yeah,
no,
thank you. Thank you for calling in.
Yeah, I always enjoy listening to you guys, and I just thought I'd give it a call and say hi.
Hey,
thank you, Rocky.
Okay.
You know,
you guys,
good,
have a
bye-bye,
good.
Guy. You know, a lot of people aren't brave enough to call us.
No, I noticed that over the years. Yeah.
I'm always thankful when someone's brave enough
to
pick up the phone and dial his number. Okay, we have a choice. We can end with a piece of score from Rampart, from The Gray, from Underworld Awakening, or a new piano version of Up. What do you want?
Well, all right, who does the score for Rampart?
You would ask me that.
I would ask you. Right, you don't know. Okay. You want to go with you want to go with Up? When you sounded like you were interested in Up, I'm just going on your vocals.
Let's do Up because we ended this on such an up note.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
beautiful,
exactly.
Beautiful. It's a new album of piano versions of Pixar themes. And here's Up. We'll close on that. Enjoy whatever you're watching tonight. What are you watching tonight?
I guess I'm gonna watch The Walking Dead. I hope. I mean, I don't know, though. I'm not sure. I mean, either The Walking Dead or probably Downton Abbey or some of the Grammys, you know. What about you?
I got everything TiVo'd. I mean, I'm TiVo'ing the BAFTAs. I'm TiVo'ing the Grammys. I'm TiVo'ing Walking Dead and Luck. I'm still trying to give that a try. But
I haven't watched any. Is it any? I mean, let's end on this. Is it anything to write home about so far? Or?
It's a slow slog, but I understand it really picks up. But
we're
slow
banking
burn.
On that then. Okay.
Yeah, I just, you know, you got to give a Hoffman and a Mann and a Nolte the benefit of the doubt, you know?
Right, yeah, of course. Of course.
Yeah. All right, so I don't know when we'll be back, but we'll continue to have Oscar interviews throughout the next 2 weeks, but we might be back Wednesday or Sunday night, it depends.
Okay.
I'll let you know.
Okay, thank you. All right, good night, everyone.
Good night, everybody.